Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Alan Kratz, registration number 27367, here on behalf of Mr. Peppers, the appellant. I'd be happy to try to answer any of this court's questions regarding any of the issues presented, but today I would like to focus on the first issue in Mr. Peppers' opening brief, whether the state presented substantial and sufficient evidence of identity, where their evidence consisted of DNA evidence, but without any evidence as to its source, and without any further significant corroborative proof. This court no doubt is aware that in its decision in Clark, this court held that DNA evidence standing alone can be insufficient without some sort of corroborative proof. And I think it's useful to discuss the evidence in Clark and contrast it with the evidence in this case. In Clark, the source of the DNA evidence was identified as being seminal fluid, which does not present the same risk of transference as tissue or hair. In Clark, the DNA evidence was found on a recently purchased item of clothing. It had been purchased, according to the Supreme Court opinion, 2 days previously. So there was only a two-day window in which the DNA evidence could have been deposited. It was found on a jacket that was actually in contact with the victim, used to cover the victim's head. And also, the victim in Clark described her assailant, although she wasn't able to give much of a physical description, she described her assailant as having a distinctive Carhartt-type jacket. And the defendant in Clark admitted to owning just this type of jacket. And finally, in Clark, the assailant ignored the outcries of the victim's son. And the defendant, there was evidence that the defendant knew the victim's son had a disability which would prevent him from basically relating what he saw. So in the present case, what do we have? We have a very vague description of the robbers from the alleged victim and an apartment complex employee. They basically described three black men with athletic builds. The employee said they were approximately 6 feet in height, although he viewed them from a distance. He viewed them outside of the complex from a distance of 300 to 400 feet, he said. We're talking about a very large distance. And he said they were approximately 6 feet in height. Mr. Peppers is a black man, but he's only 5 feet, 7 inches in height. And no evidence was presented that he had an athletic build. No evidence was presented that he had that he owned a baseball cap or any other distinctive type of clothing.
Counsel, why don't all of those questions go to cross-examination by the defense? Why isn't this properly a question for the jury to decide?
Well, I think it's, as the division pointed out in Clark, that what you have is a situation where all you have is DNA evidence. It could be skin or tissue, which, as this court discussed at length in Clark, is subject to innumerable mechanisms for transfer. So that's why, in that kind of situation, you need something more than just that.
But why isn't the witness description, even though certainly it's subject to being questioned, why isn't that additional corroboration, again, that can be tested in front of a jury?
Your Honor, it just seems like this description has very minimal probative value. About the only thing it tells you is that the robbers were black men. Otherwise, it's inconsistent with Mr. Peppers. So clearly, that evidence has very little probative value on the question of identity. So that's why the prosecution below relied almost exclusively on the DNA evidence, arguing that it basically was conclusive in putting Mr. Peppers at the crime scene.
Mr. Kratz, by arguing that the evidence that you've described has minimal probative value, aren't you really conceding that it is for the jury to determine whether that minimum was enough?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Obviously, in cases involving insufficient evidence, evidence gets presented, relevant evidence. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily for the jury. The court still has to make a determination as to whether a reasonable juror would necessarily have a reasonable doubt in light of the evidence presented. So that's the legal question here. Just because some evidence has slight probative value does not answer that question.
Well, certainly the evidence in Clark was more significant, but that doesn't mean that all cases have to have that much corroborative evidence, does it?
Probably not. Okay. But I don't think this court has to deal with the boundaries there. I think the evidence here is so clearly insufficient that even if something less than what was required in Clark might be sufficient, we don't have that here. An example might be cases where, for example, sexual assault cases, where the sole evidence is DNA, but it's found, say, in vaginal or anal locations, and the source of the DNA is semen. Well, that pretty much eliminates most innocent explanations for how it got there. So that might be a situation where the evidence may be less than what was in Clark, but it might be sufficient. But we don't have that in this case. In this case, we have no evidence as to the source of the DNA. It was found on a bed sheet that had been purchased 2 months previously, whereas in Clark, it was only a two-day window. The only evidence as to where it had been was in response to a jury question where the alleged victim testified that he had recently cleaned it. But he didn't elaborate on that, and no one asked him about it, what he meant by that. No one asked him where it had been in that two-month time period. So I would like to also point out that the alleged victim, Diaz, was shown a photo lineup. Peppers was in the number four position. Diaz did not identify him. There was no evidence that Diaz recognized Peppers' voice as being one of the robbers, even though the evidence was substantial that the robbers made many statements during the course of the robbery. And of course, there was no evidence as to the source of the DNA. And finally, 13 latent fingerprints were taken from this crime scene, but none of them matched Mr. Peppers.
Isn't it significant that Diaz testified that Peppers, he never invited Peppers into his home, that Peppers had never been there?
That is correct. He did testify to that effect. I would point out, though, that in Ray, the fingerprint case, with which this court is probably familiar, that an argument was made that, well, there's no innocent explanation for this fingerprint being on this milk chute. And the Supreme Court held that that wasn't really a factor that made a difference in the substantial and sufficient evidence test. They still found insufficient evidence based on that fingerprint evidence alone. Now, of course, in the Supreme Court's opinion in Clark, the Supreme Court affirmed this court's holding of insufficient evidence. They do have some cautionary language in there about how the fingerprint cases do not define the substantial and sufficient evidence test. But they never come out and say that they have no relevance to the substantial and sufficient evidence test. And indeed, in Ray, for example, the court is very clear that it's just applying that test, the Bennett test for substantial and sufficient evidence.
The Supreme Court took us back to Bennett.
Correct.
And that's the standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that cautionary language was just to the effect that, to the extent you're saying that there's some separate test, that the fingerprint cases announce some separate test, that's not right. But otherwise, they uphold this court's holding and do not contradict this court's discussion about certain types of DNA evidence, how its probative value is substantially reduced when it's, say, from tissue or hair, because those are subject to innumerable mechanisms for transference. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve what time I have left for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jillian Price, registration number 40815, and I represent the people. This court should affirm Mr. Pepper's convictions because none of the issues he has raised on appeal constitute error, let alone reversible error. Turning to the sufficiency issue, the fingerprint test that we've been discussing as articulated in People v. Ray does not apply to this case. The sufficient and substantial evidence test articulated in Bennett does. Now in People v. Ray, a fingerprint was found on a mail chute, on the exterior of a mail chute, which is in a public area. There was no other evidence in that case whatsoever to corroborate the defendant's guilt. And under those circumstances, where we have a fingerprint left in a public place that could have been left by innocent means, that was insufficient to sustain the conviction. Now in this case, by contrast, Mr. Pepper's DNA was found inside the victim's apartment, so not a public place, and it was found on the very strips of bedsheet that were used to bind the victim. Now, the DNA expert in this case testified that regardless of the source of the DNA, whether it is hair, whether it is sweat, whether it is saliva, whether it was seminal or vaginal fluid, all DNA is the same, regardless of the source. There was no evidence in this case that there was any there were any flaws in the DNA analysis based on the source.
Counsel, does this then become a battle of the experts, in which case it necessarily has to go to the jury?
I disagree that it's a battle of the experts, but you're right. It is for the jury to determine whether or not that evidence was sufficient. And whether or not, when viewed as a whole in the light most favorable to the prosecution, that evidence was sufficient to allow that jury to determine guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And here, the DNA analysis matched Mr. Pepper's. Now, under those circumstances, the Bennett test is satisfied. And again, there's been no evidence and no case law that specifically articulates that DNA from skin cells, sweat, saliva is in any way, shape, or form less accurate than DNA from other bodily fluids. And again, this is corroborated by the expert's testimony at trial. Even if the fingerprint evidence test were in effect, which it's not, this case is distinct from the factual situations presented in People v. Ray. Now, in People v. Clark, the Supreme Court also articulated that the people are not required to disprove every potential hypothesis aside from guilt. The prosecution is not required to disprove that Peppers might have left the DNA through some inadvertent act. The prosecution was not required to establish that the DNA could only have been deposited at the time of the crime. There's no requirement that the prosecution do what the defense counsel is suggesting that it should have done at trial. The evidence showed that Mr. Pepper's DNA was on the sheets that were used to bind the victim inside the apartment. Prosecution was not required to disprove any other hypothesis. And also, there was no evidence at trial that Mr. Pepper's was ever in the shared laundry room where the sheets may or may not have been cleaned. There is no evidence that Mr. Pepper's was ever inside the victim's apartment aside from the crime. There's no evidence that the victim ever had any knowledge of Mr. Pepper's, that they had ever met, that they had ever had any interactions before. All of this evidence, when taken as a whole, and in combination with the fact that both the victim and the apartment manager said that they saw three African-American males, constitutes sufficient evidence to support these crimes. I would be more than happy to address any questions that this court has on any of the issues raised in this case. Well, based on the reasons articulated here and those stated in the briefs, the people respectfully request that this court affirm Mr. Pepper's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a couple of quick corrections to counsel's argument. First, the evidence was that the DNA in this case was not found on strips of bed sheet that were used to bind the victim. Instead, they were found on two other strips of sheet, and the evidence was uncontradicted at trial that these strips were not used to bind the victim. They were characterized as test strips, although that was the witnesses in the case admitted that was purely speculation on their part, that they were test strips. And I think it's important also to emphasize that not all DNA evidence is created equal, and that was the point of this court's discussion in Clark, that when you have a situation where DNA is from, say, tissue or hair, then the science shows that there are innumerable mechanisms where it can be primarily or secondarily transferred. And for that reason, it requires speculation and conjecture to conclude that just because such DNA is on an item like this, that the defendant was necessarily present at the crime scene and deposited the DNA there at that time. So just the magic words DNA is not enough. You have to examine what's the source of the DNA. That evidence wasn't presented here, what the source was. Therefore, it might have been skin or tissue, and therefore was subject to being easily transferred. There was no evidence presented as to where the sheet had been for 2 months. All we had was evidence that had been recently washed, but no elaboration from the alleged victim as to when that occurred. So there was plenty of time for this sheet to have been somewhere outside of this apartment, whether down the laundry room, where, by the way, the evidence showed that anyone could use those laundry facilities, anyone could get the card needed to operate those machines. So there was plenty of time for this sheet to pick up DNA from who knows where. And it was the state's burden to eliminate all those innocent explanations, and they didn't do it at all in this case. And if there's no further questions, I would just ask that the judgment of conviction be reversed.
Thank you to both counsel for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written decision will issue in due course.